You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On March 1st, LAPD officers shot and killed an unarmed, homeless black man in the streets of L.A.'s Skid Row. In a video taken by a bystander that went viral online, three police officers pinned Charlie Kanang to the sidewalk and shot him six times. His death became another dismal statistic, the 180th person to die at the hands of an officer this year, a number that KilledByPolice.net says rose to 654 just yesterday. Although most of those killings have been deemed justified, quite a few remain under a cloud, and many go largely unnoticed. In a story for the July issue of GQ magazine titled The Invisible Man, The End of a Black Life That Mattered, Jeff Charlotte, an associate professor of creative writing at Dartmouth College, reported from L.A. Skid Row and recreated a life whose only public recognition is the tragic way that it ended. I'm very pleased it has brought Jeff Charlotte back to our show. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Good to be with you again.
Who was Charlie Africa Kanang?
He was a Cameroonian immigrant. He had come to the United States in the late 90s to pursue his dream of being an actor. He's from a middle-class family in Douala, Cameroon. Had gone to college, studied math and physics, but he loved Robert De Niro, and he came to Hollywood thinking that he could be the next Robert De Niro and study at the Beverly Hills Playhouse. And America did not work out for him. He made some bad decisions and ended up on Skid Row, ended up homeless, living in a tent until the day that he ran into the LAPD.
On March 1st, police said that they were responding to a robbery call. Was there any indication that that was actually happening?
No, that's incorrect, in fact. What the police have said is incorrect. Although we can't be 100% certain because they won't release the 911 call. And here's one of the things that we see in the way that you mentioned police, most of these killings being justified. When it's clearly justified, police release body cams. It's on 11 o'clock news. They release all the evidence. They haven't released anything. So I had to track down the man who had allegedly made the robbery call, a man named LaRue Curls. And he was one of Africa's best friends. He lived next to him. They had gotten in a scuffle that morning. He had not been robbed. He did not, according to internal interviews with some of the police shooters that I was able to listen to through a leak, he did not say that he had been robbed. Nothing adds up here. On Skid Row, the most policed area in the United States, you get three squad cars for an open container of beer. For this so-called robbery call, they responded with one kind of lackadaisical officer at first and it escalated when it turned to violence.
Police claim that Charlie kicked LaRue and threatened him with a mini baseball bat. But does anybody claim to have actually seen that bat?
No, that's another one of the huge glaring discrepancies that comes up when you listen to the unreleased internal police interviews with Officer Martinez, who was the first shooter. And the detectives interviewing him seem to be trying to help him out. And I mean, that's my speculation, but they are going to great ends to find this bat. Which he just didn't see, didn't exist, didn't ask anybody about on the unreleased body cams that you can hear. Then they ask him to describe the bat that he says he never saw, and he gives a physical description of what he imagines that bat would look like. And that's what translated into the public accounts of this threat that when I spoke to LaRue Curls, never happened.
I've just learned that there is a further complication. Lost in the debate is a second actor in the confrontation, a thin black woman who stepped into the frame of the video and picked up a nightstick one of the officers had dropped during the struggle with Charlie. And this woman, Trishawn Cardessa Carey, has been charged with assault with a deadly weapon against a police officer and resisting arrest, although she could go to jail for 25 years to life in prison under California's three-strike sentencing law for repeat offenders. And she didn't do anything. Everybody admits that she didn't swing it. Just picking it up is enough to be considered a threat.
On Skid Row, living on Skid Row is enough to be considered a threat. The Downtown Developers Association of L.A. actually has referred to homeless people as the threat to the urban renaissance. Trishawn Carey, her street name was Nicki Minaj. The tiny little woman weighed a little bit over 100 pounds. was not mentally well, did pick up the stick. You can watch it on the video. She picks up the stick. What she's going to do with it, it's unclear. She didn't touch anybody. Now they're claiming that there's at least six officers at the time, and these officers are claiming, again in these internal interviews, that they were all terrified of this 100-pound woman who picked up this stick that the rookie dropped for no good reason, not because he was in a fight, because he seemed to have forgotten that he was holding it in his hand. It's the incompetence compounding sort of this kind of, I have to say, I think it's a cover-up. They had Trishon on bail of $1,085,000. That's more than Dylann Roof's first bail was. They didn't want her to talk to the press. It took a lot of work for me to get into the jail to see her.
And now it's been reduced to $50,000, which I suspect she can't come up with either.
She has a lot of supporters in the community. And one of the things that I think sometimes gets lost in some of these stories, especially about Skid Row and poverty, is there's a sense of this place as this kind of wretched place of the damned. And it is a very troubled place. But there's people who push back. There's an organization called Los Angeles Community Action Network that has been supporting Trishon Carey. She's being represented by the lawyer who represented Rodney King, Milton Grimes. And that reduction of the bail was in response to a judge looking at this and saying, this is just plain ridiculous. $1 million bail for a woman who did not touch anybody. The only touching that was done is when the police tackled her and banged her to the ground.
You're right that Skid Row is referred to as a police containment zone where, as you pointed out, an open can of beer will draw multiple squad cars. But what is a police containment zone?
So this is, it's chilling. The containment zone is actually an official city term. It goes back to the late 70s, although Skid Row is much older than that. And it was the idea that Los Angeles, which has some of the highest, I believe right now it is the highest population of homeless, and the Skid Row is the densest population of homeless in the United States and really, well beyond, that they would compress all the services, soup kitchens, the like, and so on, down into this one little sort of warehouse district away from downtown LA, get the homeless people away, and then draw sharp borders. It's 50 square blocks. And if you cross out of that, you're going to be subject to even harsher policing. Within it, you might be able to put up a tent. You might be able to survive.
And then there's the Safer Cities Initiative Task Force that enforces this.
Yeah, this is a Safer Cities for who? This is, I've never seen policing like this. I've reported all over the world. I've just never seen policing like this.
Isn't it similar in concept to the broken windows approach that William Bratton, New York City's current police commissioner, formerly the LA police commissioner, has been such a strong advocate of?
Yeah. It began when Bratton was chief of police at LA and continues under one of his proteges, a guy named Charlie Beck, who, like Bratton, I think has, and I think incorrectly, a sort of a reputation for, in some ways, a kind of progressive policing. What you really see in the safer cities, the broken windows, the zero tolerance, the threat reduction that they're talking about in LA is the compression of a huge population of people into a small area. And then here's a statistic that'll give you a sense of it. The first year of the Safer Cities Initiative, they gave out, for a population about 15,000, they gave out 12,000 jaywalking tickets. Half of those, not even for the serious crime of jaywalking, but for simply still being in the crosswalk when the light starts blinking to say it's almost over. The tickets are high, $200. The police gave me one while I was trying to report when they knew I was a reporter. And the homeless people can't pay them. And what happens is that then it gets worse and worse until it becomes a warrant, an outstanding warrant, and it becomes another means of control and for keeping the homeless away from downtown LA, which is in the midst of its so-called urban renaissance.
So according to a UCLA study, in the first year of Safer Cities, the police issued 12,000 citations. 80% of them were for pedestrian violations.
Yeah.
And you write that the containment approach to policing is really recycling. What do you mean by that?
It's a sort of this constant churn. You would see, there'd be people. I spent a total of 2.5 weeks there, and I would be talking to people, and then they would disappear for a little while. Then I'd see them again, and they'd gone to jail. They'd been picked up for having a beer or picked up for jaywalking, and they had an outstanding warrant for a previous jaywalking. They'd go to jail for a few days, and they didn't really hold them, although another chilling statistic, the biggest mental health facility in the United States is the Los Angeles County Jail. That's the treatment that we have. So, but they'd hold them there for a few days and then they'd get out. And it's a way of controlling that population, keeping them in the containment zone, what police call, even more bluntly, they call it the box, keep them in the box. So recycle them. And hope that eventually they'll move on. Maybe they'll move to San Diego. That's the great hope of L.A.
Jeff Charlotte's article, The Invisible Man, The End of a Black Life That Mattered, is in the current issue of GQ magazine. You looked at unreleased police body camera videos from Charlie Kenang's shooting. What did they show that we can't see on the online video?
The online video is just the last few seconds, and there's just a huge number of discrepancies. In the online video, we see clearly the police hold the man down and shoot him. I got into this story because I asked my journalism students who knew nothing about it, I said, look at this video, what do you see happening? And they said, the police just held that guy down and killed him. And they were astonished. And this was, you know, we had adult journalists saying, well, it's complicated. It's not complicated. They hold him down and shot him, and that's the bottom line. But when we look at these body cams, we see even more. On the video that's viral, he seems to be punching at the cops. And the body cams that are close up, we see that he has taser wires in his back, and he's twisting. He's fighting the wire, trying to get the wire out. The body cams begin much earlier. The police say that he wasn't making sense, that he was shouting, that he had fists clenched, that he was advancing. We look at the body cams, we see a man who doesn't move, whose arms are by his side, whose hands are open every second, who is saying, just let me express myself. Let me express myself, trying to reason with the cops, the very cops who would then say he wasn't making any sense. He was out of control.
Don't you have to go to court to get some of those videos made available? I'm thinking about newly released dash cam videos from California's Gardena Police Department that show the police killing an unarmed man and wounding another in L.A.'s in the suburb of L.A. 2 years ago. And a judge ordered the footage to be released after the AP and L.A. Times brought it to court. Yeah. Otherwise, it would not have been made available. And haven't the police and others objected to the judge's ruling?
Yeah, they have, although it's always made available if it exonerates the police. Again, it'll be on the 11 o'clock news that very same day. In this case, we have this very strange situation where we're supposed to trust the police account of what happened, where the LA Times, God bless them, actually reported, well, the police say the body cam show X, Y, and Z. And as a reporter, that's not an account that I'm going to take. I want to see with my own two eyes. So
in that case,
I was able to see it, and I, you know, through a leak, and I can't really say more about how, because the fact of the matter is the LA County DA isn't pressing this issue. This is a politically, you know, there's Tamir Rice, there's Eric Garner, there's Michael Brown, there's Sandra Bland, and it's this great moment where people are fighting for justice for these people. But in LA, there's Azelle Ford, there's Brendan Glenn, there's Carlos Acana, homeless men who no one is championing.
Now, there has been a growing push for more police body cameras and dashboard cameras. Do they provide additional security and police accountability? Because I was thinking in the light of the fact that there have already been something like 654 deaths as of yesterday, and this is just the first 7 months of the year, it doesn't seem that they've had much of an impact on the way the police have acted in certain cases.
Yeah, I have to say, I was skeptical of body cams when I learned that one of the big manufacturers is Taser, the company that makes Tasers, which is in many cases effectively a torture device. It was for Charlie. They held him down, tased him in the leg, tased him in the crotch. They're making body cams and marketing them as a tool for protecting your police. And that's because the way the law works is if the police want to release it and say, look, our cop is innocent, and that's good. If a cop, you know, was justified, we should know, and that cop should be protected. If they don't want to release it, if it doesn't show something that they wanted to show, they can just sit on it and sit on it and sit on it. And it takes a really concerted public effort to get it. And in some cases, they don't. That Gardena case had the efforts of some real powerhouse lawyers working on that. And it took them years to see a video that when we watch it is just plain as day murder.
We're going to come back with more talk about tasers and related matters as we continue this conversation with Jeff Charlotte, Associate Professor of Creative Writing at Dartmouth College. His article, The Invisible Man, The End of a Black Life That Mattered, is in the current issue of GQ magazine. We're back with Jeff Charlotte, Sharlett. His article, The Invisible Man, The End of a Black Life That Mattered, is in the current issue of GQ magazine. Many of the killings by police have been justified, especially when the gunman is shooting at a lot of innocent people. But so many of these incidents have occurred as a result of rather minor offenses. In Cincinnati this past weekend, a black driver was fatally shot by a white cop during a traffic stop over a missing license plate. And then there's the matter of Sandra Bland, the police who changed lanes without signaling. She said she was actually forced to do it by a police car. You have to, in the end, part of the issue there was that the cop got so abusive he threatened to taser. He said, "I will light you up."
Yeah, and I think, you know, the sad thing is what's really the only thing that's remarkable about the Sandra Bland case is that there was a bystander with who was filming it, and that we know about it. As you say, there's so many more of these cases that we don't hear. In the month of March alone, the month that Charlie Kenang was killed, 36 black people were killed by police, 17 of them unarmed. And when you're talking about an unarmed person, there's just no reason that it needs to come to that. And you see this again and again in the killings and L.A., Carlos Acana, who was killed half a block away from Charlie by LAPD just months before. He was a mentally ill man known as the tree man, because he liked to climb up trees, just be peaceful. And he climbed up on a billboard, and he wasn't coming down fast enough. So they shot him with, I think, beanbags, and he fell to his death. Azel Ford is another homeless, not a homeless man, actually, in L.A., and in a rare instance, the LA Police Commission just decided that although they ruled that his killing was justified, that once the conflict had begun, it was justified. However, they said, and this is very important, the conflict didn't need to begin. The police didn't need to stop him. And that's true of Charlie Kenang. The police say that he reached for the gun. The video shows that his hand was not on the gun when they shot him. It just wasn't. But even beyond all that, even if you say, look, he was out of control at that point, why were cops surrounding a man? Why were they approaching mentally ill people like this? Why do so many unarmed people die? Of that 654, I believe somewhere in between a fifth and a sixth are unarmed. Unarmed.
Authorities initially said that Sandra Bland had become argumentative and uncooperative after she was pulled over. Why is argumentative so often used in these situations? And another thing that we often hear is that the victim was reaching for the policeman's gun.
Yeah.
How often does that actually happen?
How often do victims reach for the policeman's gun? I don't know. I mean, in the case of Charlie, you cannot see him reaching for the gun on the video. On the other hand, there's four cops on top of him beating him in his own home, as it were. There's taser wires in his back and they're tasing him in his crotch, and he may think he's going to die. And what would you do in that instance? But Sandra Bland was not reaching for the gun. We hear no of other instances. An instance of some, I believe, New Jersey cops who claimed that the gun had been reached for, until later dash cam video emerges and says he was nowhere near it. There's any number of these cases where the cops say, he's reaching for my gun, he's reaching for my gun. Charlie, after he's dead, after they shot him six times, the cops are in a circle around him and they know people are watching them. They say to the body, stop resisting, stop resisting. That's performance. And the same thing with the argumentative. That's language that the police have learned to use. Some of that language, for instance, in Charlie's case, they kept talking about fist clenched. That's not casual language. That means that that person poses a threat. Argumentative is a stage of conflict. And in every one of these cases, we just sort of have to look at why is the conflict coming to this point? What are the forces that are pushing the police? And I think there is something to be said for the difficult position the police are in. What are the forces that are pushing them to escalate and escalate and escalate?
Many people see this very much in racial terms, but you note that the LAPD has become remarkably diverse, 43% Latino, 31% white, 15% black. To what extent do those demographics matter when it comes to policing poverty-stricken areas like Skid Row?
most of the formal social science studies show that they don't matter at all. And I think this can be summed up in a very concise way by Pete White, a community organizer in Skid Row with this group LA Can. He says, it's not the color of the cop, it's the color of the institution. And I think that's very much true, that the police that I spoke to in Skid Row saw themselves, spoke of themselves in the terms that you hear used for an occupying force, which is essentially what they are, one cop per square block. And to put that in perspective, if you went over to suburban Van Nuys and tried to have that level of policing, you'd have to add 1,700 police officers. So if the cop is put in this position of being an occupying force and sort of told that civilians are his enemy, he's being set up for conflict almost as much as the people who end up becoming victims are.
Weren't pretty much all of the officers involved in Charlie's case minority officers? Sergeant Chand Sayed, Officer Francisco Martinez, Officer Joshua Velasquez?
Yes, they were. And I think the idea, as they were in the killing of Freddie Gray, we need to talk about race as being a way that police officers, regardless of their own race, tend to classify people. No hard numbers on this, but just a lot of time spent at Skid Row and talking to people, white and black, and white folks would tell you just as quickly that the policing in Skid Row is much tougher on black people and the policing by officers of color. We're asking police to essentially, in places like L.A., to essentially police color lines, to police class lines, and to police gentrification. And when you give them that task, that's the person's job. It doesn't particularly matter that much who that person is. You've given them a job that can only be enforced through conflict.
I'm talking with Jeff Charlotte. His article, The Invisible Man, The End of a Black Life That Mattered, is in the current issue of GQ magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. South African photographer Pieter Hugo spent 10 days with you on Skid Row shooting hundreds of portraits. What do they reveal about the way society looks at homelessness?
One of the things that if you go and you look at Peter's photographs, and really an astonishing photographer, and there's a portrait gallery on GQ's website. He really wanted to capture people looking back at the camera. He did not want to ennoble anybody. A lot of people are in very, very bad shape. People who are living outside, people who are struggling with addiction and mental illness. But they still have that human dignity. And I think that's, to me, that's part of the reason that I wanted to write about Charlie Kunang. Here was a man, he's an ex-con, he's maybe mentally ill, he's using drugs, he's homeless. He's got some fight in him. He doesn't want to back down when the cops try to sort of confront him in his own house. And yet he has this dignity. Part of the ways in which we police poverty in the United States is we tend to make it either, and sometimes the left makes a mistake of sort of saying that every sort of poor person is a saint, and the right says that they're kind of dangerous monsters and they're verging. Big surprise, they're just people, just like everybody else, except dealing with a greater burden of suffering. Skid Row is not a dangerous place, in fact, for the outsider. You can go and walk around. It's much less dangerous than other parts of L.A., and you can talk to people and discover, as Pieter Hugo shows in these photographs, the dignity that people have as they struggle.
Do police have alternatives to criminalizing the Skid Row population? Have they intervened with social programs to address the homelessness?
You know, there's police officers there who would really like to. And a complaint that I think is a very legitimate complaint by police officers is, why are we being put in the position to do essentially what all the social services that have been gutted by government to pay for lower taxes? The police are now being put in a position of being mental health workers. The LAPD, the Safer Cities Task Force, has something called the SMART Team. It's supposed to be mental health professionals that show up. Nobody, it's been there for 9 years. I never found anybody who'd ever seen them. I spoke to a police sergeant and I said, how come they weren't called down the three or four blocks to deal with Charlie? You had plenty of time if you thought he was a risk. You had plenty of time. And he just sort of rubbed his fingers together, the universal symbol for not enough money, and said, resources, the SMART team sit in the back. They're not doing their job. And instead, we're sending out police with guns who are trained to deal with lawbreakers and asking them to deal with mentally ill people who society has just shuffled into this box.
And you mentioned three other unarmed, mentally ill homeless men who were shot by the LAPD in circumstances similar to Charlie's.
Yeah, yeah.
So what does that reveal about training?
I'm very wary of some people say we got to focus on training, and in fact the LAPD, Los Angeles County law enforcement, if we include the sheriffs, they're up to, I think it's 22 or 23 killed this year. That compares to Germany and UK combined for I don't know how many years back. They kill about one or zero people a year. 23, that so far outpaces any other police force in the country. And they announced that they're going to practice de-escalation, but they're going to train officers in de-escalation. The reality is Sergeant Saeed, one of the shooters of Charlie Kunang, he's de-escalating right up to the moment he kills Charlie. He's saying, come on, brother, it's not a big deal. He's certainly not responding like this is a big threat. He's like, come on, brother, come on, you got to do this. Right up to the moment he's shooting them. And the question is, what is the law they are enforcing there? When you try and take people out of their homes and put them against the wall, when you tell people that they can't have their tent on the sidewalk, when across the street the hipster bistro can have its tables on the sidewalk, and you try and tell them they have nowhere to go, you're going to get conflict. And the police know that. And the police are as troubled by it, I think, actually, as others.
Well, it's stressful to be stopped by a police officer. We don't always behave with perfect control when we feel we're being treated unjustly. And then, of course, there are those people who have mental and physical problems that just exacerbate the situation, so they're not always able to properly follow orders. But it's the citizens who are being told they must behave with perfect emotional control and so that they won't provoke the anger of officers who are supposed to be professionals.
These officers sound so fragile sometimes when they talk about them, when we talk about Sandra Bland and that she was rude to him. This is the First Amendment of the Constitution. This is part of what that revolution was about. You are allowed to be rude to police officers. That doesn't mean you should be, but it sure doesn't. It's not a death penalty offense. And, you know, I have to say, while I was out there reporting, I mentioned one day I saw three squad cars on an open container. It was a common sight. I started to walk across the road just to see what was going on, to report on it. They put a spotlight on me, and I said, I'm a reporter, and I didn't think any more of it. And they ended up detaining me, putting me over by the wall, running my license for warrants, giving me a $197 ticket for jaywalking, and not allowing me to report on that situation. And, you know, I'm a white guy. I'm a middle class guy. I was a reporter, and I was rude to them. I said, you know, this is ridiculous. You can't do this, and so on. I got away fine, and that has a lot to do with who I am. Had I been a black man saying, you can't do this to me, I would have been in cuffs against the wall. And there's no doubt about that in some of these policing zones.
I want to put Derek from the Upper West Side on. But Derek, we have very little time. Can you make it brief?
Yes. For the reporter guest, did you notice any anomalies in the video that you viewed that was in police custody and not released yet to the public? Because the Sandra Bland case out of Texas, the Chinese TV viewed 2 minutes of it with commentary yesterday, and none of the American stations are anywhere close to what they analyzed, that it's a series of jump cuts that shows the film has been altered from the dash cam video. And PBS NewsHour last night explained it as communications something trouble when they transmit it from the police to the reporters or to the news media. And as a datacom specialist from AT&T from 20 years ago, it don't work like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about the unreleased body cams, and in this case, they deal with that just by not letting the public see them, is the audio doesn't cut in for the first 30 seconds and on either of the two body cams. And this is a really curious and odd thing that gives the officer on the scene a little time before he's going to start being recorded. That's not an anomaly. That's not a technical glitch. It's a decision that's made. There's no other glitches on this video. If this is not the video they want being seen, this is the video of them holding down a man and killing them, a man who is not out of control when they confront him, a man who is not holding a gun. It is the video that tells the story that the police won't tell.
Now, we should point out that a fair number of the police shootings were as a result of a violent crime.
Yes, but that's just police doing their job. I mean, that's not something, you know, that's sort of like saying a fair number of stops for speeding are for, by people who were in fact speeding. It's not news when we do our job. It's news when we look at this number, 654, the Guardian count, I think, is 648, compared to the rest of the world, including countries like Canada that are well-armed. Nothing explains this. It's not, we can't say it's because we have more guns here. We have violent crime. We have police officers in other part of the world who are trained to deal with violent criminals, not by shooting first, asking questions later. The building in front of which Charlie was killed, Union Rescue Mission, it's a big, you know, sort of soup kitchen rescue mission, and they routinely have people who get out of control, mentally ill people, sometimes people who grab knives. They've been dealing with this for years. They've never shot anybody. They don't carry any weapons. They tackle them and hold them down. And in this case, you know, you had four cops holding him down, and still they had to shoot him. In Sandra Bland's case, you had this woman who didn't want to put out her cigarette, and so they had to slam her down to the ground. The case of John Crawford, who was shot for trying to buy a BB gun in a Walmart, but he was a black man trying to buy a BB gun. They walked in shooting. Those are the cases that matter. And there's enough of them that it goes beyond the bad apple. It goes into, when we look at these numbers, into a systemic problem.
And it's the reason for the famous talk that we hear about black parents with their kids. Just be totally respectful. Don't get the cop angry. It's sad that that talk has to be made. My great thanks to Jeff Charlotte, who's Associate Professor of Creative Writing at Dartmouth College. His article, The Invisible Man, The End of a Black Life That Mattered, is in the current issue of GQ magazine. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you, Leonard.